The dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Thank you, Doc. Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you, Francis and Sarita. Good morning. This is John Barber. Welcome to John Barber's World. It's 11 a.m. here in Las Vegas. This is my third special show, not at my regular bi-monthly Monday 5 p.m. time, again because of a very, very special guest, and I mean special indeed. But first, a couple of brief comments and a brief but necessary review of a performer you should know about. Every morning, my email is cluttered with notes from psychics telling me how they can predict the future. If they're psychic, why don't they know I'm not interested? And as you saw last night and this morning, Hillary is running around saying she won Iowa. She did not win Iowa. She won the coin toss 6 times. Do you believe that? But you know, do you know where she got the coin from? She got it from Bill. It's the one he uses every Saturday night with her. Honey, heads I get to date tonight. Tails you. Oops, heads again, honey. I just love getting heads. Ask Monica. Today, in America, we'd have at least a 50-50 chance of democracy, if that's what you call it, if we had a coin toss rather than election going to the Supreme Court. Years ago, with a coin toss, we might have had the actual winner of the presidency, Al Gore, instead of that warmongering, talking-to-God idiot Gomer Pyle from the country's political Manson family. In the 10 years I was a film critic for Los Angeles Magazine, and the 5 years at KNBC, as a media critic, of the hundreds of shows I saw, I only gave 4 standing ovations. They were Rudolf Nureyev, the majestic, powerful Russian ballet dancer I nicknamed Deep Toes. The second, the magnificent Josephine Baker at 75, making a comeback in America after fleeing decades earlier because of her color to France, where she conquered Europe and the world. The third, Hal Holbrook, for his brilliant recreation of Mark Twain Tonight. But of course, look who he had writing for him. And then the legendary touch of musical class, Lena Horne, in her one-woman show. My 5th standing ovation was last Saturday night in Los Angeles, the place, the gay lesbian theater in Hollywood, the one-man show, Sam Harris and Ham, a musical memoir. Sam Harris was evidently the first winner of a talent show called Star Search. I'd never heard of him. This was the first time, but it will not be the last. In a half a dozen really smart original songs and a few standards and dozens of captivating, honest, and often humorous stories, we hear about the catcher on the rye pains of being from the Midwest, when wanting to be of the world, wanting to be loved, wanting to be famous, and then even more loved. He was different. He was homosexual, with a voice that could shatter glass and break your heart. With the perfect piano and vocal accompaniment of Todd Schroeder, co-author of the songs, these stories, and Sam's spectacular performance of them make us suddenly realize and appreciate why theaters were built, not just to entertain us, but to tell us the truth about all of us. It is never done better in the theater than in one-person shows. And there is none better in the country today or on TV or in movies now than Sam's. As an aside, I don't know if Sam is even aware of this, but not once did he mention the word gay. I personally hate the word. Gay should be an adjective, not a noun, because most of them I know aren't. They are semi-miserable and searching for themselves just like the rest of us. But unlike the rest of us, Sam can bring you cheering to your feet. Hopefully, David Geffen, the richest homosexual in Hollywood and probably America, who built his fortune off of discovering musical talent, will put Sam's show on film or tape and bring the rest of America to its feet. And now the reason for this very, very special show, and the reason I take such a joy in it, is talking to men like this who are trying to entertain us and change the world and make it a better place to live in. A truly special guest, an actor and activist who for decades has brought people to their feet, performing as FDR on stage or speaking out against our illegal wars. And now, thank goodness for 911 Truth. Following military service for his country, he became part of Chicago's Compass Players and famous Second City, then on to Broadway, deservedly so, and then more deservedly, a monster hit as Lou Grant on Mary Tyler Moore. He was truly the solid anchor of that show, which made the others float and shine. His unbelievable versatility and accomplishments have won him more Emmys than any actor in history. 7, count them, 7, and the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Screen Actors Guild. Unlike most of our rich and famous artists, he has all his life put his career where his conscience is. It is more than an honor to have him here, Ed Asner. Ed, welcome to the show, and thank you so much.
I'm going to carry you on my lapel wherever I go.
Oh, how sweet is that? I can sit shiver for you, Ed. Hey,
I want you to use that intro everywhere I go. To open doors, to cabs, Ubers, whatever.
Well, bless your heart and bless your work. You know, last night, I must tell you, I watched Architects and Engineers, that wonderful piece that you hosted about Building 7, and then I reread all about you. But the weirdest thing occurred to me, Ed, was reading about you being from Kansas City. When I was a kid, a really young kid, I wanted to be a hockey player. One day I heard Alfred Drake singing, "Everything's up to date in Kansas City," and I thought, my God, it'd be great to earn a living like that. Tell me, what was it like growing up Orthodox in Kansas City, and then whatever inspired you to do what you evidently did, and did you ever imagine the life, the amazing life and career that you had?
No, I never imagined it, never. I became an actor because it was, I guess you call it a combination of therapy and escape, but escape is often therapy.
That it is. What was it like growing up Orthodox?
Or served in place of therapy, let's put it that way.
Did you require that therapy because you grew up Orthodox in Kansas City? And
yeah.
Was growing up in Kansas City the thing that made you so conscious of helping others?
No, I moved to Kansas City because of that, and I'd say my parents did more to instill that in me than Kansas City. But Kansas City, I used to describe it this way. Being a Jew in Kansas City, being an Orthodox Jew, that discrimination was certainly for a Jew. I won't speak for blacks or Mexicans. Certainly for a Jew was less stringent than the rest of the country, I would say. It was gentler. The discrimination was gentler.
Well, that's nice. When you got to Chicago, why did you pick the university in Chicago to go to school? And what was it you were interested in majoring in?
I was vaguely interested in political science. And I had a cousin who was going there majoring in political science at the time. It was far enough removed from Kansas City, about 550 miles. that it would break that hold of being the youngest, the lowest man on the totem pole. And it seemed to be the right place to go.
How did you discover the Compass Players? And when you got involved in your escape or your therapy and getting in with the Compass Players and then later Second City, did you feel more comfortable as a Jew in that setting because there were so many Jews, creative Jews, in that field?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, it's a liberal setting. There certainly is a higher proportion of Jews involved in that, in theater generally. After I got out of the Army, just before I got out of the Army, Paul Sills wrote me where I was stationed in France and said, come join us. We'll put on classics and new plays. I had known Paul at the university. I came back, spent a week at home, went to Chicago, saw the opening night of their second play on North Avenue, and began rehearsals the next day for the third play, which was Wozzeck.
Was what?
Then followed about 2 years plus of 25 plays of classics and new plays.
How wonderful.
Out of that, Paul and his partner David Shepherd said they wanted to do more of a people's theater. That just traditional theater wasn't satisfying their people's theater want. More liberal theater, I suppose.
Absolutely.
So they began Compass. And out of that, and though some of the people in the company joined Compass, I wanted to take all those great reviews I had gotten from the theater and run to New York and capitalize on those reviews.
You did. Was Three Penny Opera your first major role on Broadway?
Well, it was off Broadway.
Oh, it was off Broadway. Was that the first for you?
The Lucille Lortel, the Theater Delice, now named the Lortel. We had done Three Penny as a pirated version at Playwrights. And they didn't pursue us criminally. I got to New York and I exposed myself to the two producers of the Three Penny Opera in New York. And they were bemused by my audacity. They said, we'll see. And several months later, they called me. I was booked for a one-night show at the Phoenix Theater, so I couldn't do it. And I bemoaned the fact. And Carmen Capalbo, one of the producers, said, oh, don't worry. We'll be calling you again. And they did. And I spent a few months as Bob the Saw, a member of the gang, and then got elevated to taking over the role of Peachum.
Like most struggling actors, Ed, did you have to go out and search for agents or managers, or did some of them pursue you once they saw you? Because I know in some cases, for example, a case of Woody Allen. I mean, Woody Allen was actually made by Jack Rollins. Without Jack to manage him, I don't think there would have been a Woody Allen. How about in your case?
Well, when I first got to New York, I had all my pictures, rough-edged as they were, and I said, I don't expect to be hired, but I'm going to go drop in every producer's office, every agent's office, and that way I'll learn New York. And by God, I did it in the first few months I was there, and let's see, who was my first? Oh, yeah, I didn't have an agent, and then I toyed at having an agent. and then in 50, I arrived in New York in the fall of 55. In around winter of 56. Oh, Christ. I can't remember his name. Frank. He was in the show with me. He was a director actor. And he invited Jerry Orbach and me to that he'd fix us a steak dinner between shows so we could have a proper meal. It was at his girlfriend's place, which was nearby, and his girlfriend had her girlfriend show up as well. She worked for the Lucy Kroll Agency. And I played the ultimate gentleman with her. And she used her power at the agency to bring me in. And I, from that point on, had an agent.
Oh, how wonderful.
But an agent that didn't mean anything. Lucy Kroll didn't mean anything to me.
Well, how did Lou Grant come about?
I had done a semi-comedic role in a movie at 20th. Grant Tinker was in the officialdom at 20th at the time. He mentioned me to Alan Burns and Jim Brooks and when they were casting Mary. They asked about... They even asked Ethel Winant, who was vice president in charge of talent at CBS, can Ed Asner do comedy? She said, Ed Asner can do anything, she said. Of course, she didn't know, but she was in my corner. So they called me in. I read the script. It was a delightful script. First script. And I read. I'd only done two comedies since I'd been in California. And Jim Brooks said, well, now that was a very intelligent reading. And I could hear the doom written in that. Yeah, intelligent but not funny. Ha, ha, ha. He said, when we have you back to read with Mary, I don't know why they were having me back. I want you to read it wild, wiggy, far out, crazy. And I said, So I started to leave. I turned back and I said, listen, why don't you see if I can read it that way now? And if I don't do it, don't have me back. I've never spoken with that kind of courage before or since.
Wow.
Yeah. So they said, well, we do have another appointment. But okay, go ahead. So I read it, and they laughed approvingly. They said, read it just like that when you come back with Mary. And I don't know how the hell I read it, just crazily. So I came back, and I read crazily. They laughed again. And then after I left, years later, I heard that Mary then turned to them and said, are you sure?
What?
Said, that's your Lou Grant.
What did she say?
Are you sure? Scared the hell out of her.
Well, I must tell you, Ed, truthfully, you were the anchor that did make the show. And the amazing thing about your performance, the thing that I cannot stand about most television, what they call sitcoms today, and there's some guy on a show, I forget his name because I don't want to remember his name. He is an obvious homosexual, but on the show, he's not convincing enough to tell me that he's a heterosexual. They all are performing as though they know they're doing comedy. Your performance, like you were a solid actor. Angry as hell trying to keep this organization together, and you were responsible for making them the successes they were, aside from the brilliant writing of the scripts that I might have had.
No, you just can't say enough about that writing.
Oh my God, it was
just so superb.
And I knew Alan quite well. I had met him. His previous partner, Chris Hayward, they tried to get me to star in a pilot, one of their early episodes, so I knew Alan quite well. And then, of course, Brooks, both of them together were just absolutely, absolutely fabulous. Now, you said you had never displayed such courage, but I must tell you, you are displaying a whole lot more courage now with that wonderful 15-minute piece of film that everybody should see about architects and engineers and the questions about Building 7. Whatever attracted you to that? And I might add that in the film, Mike Gravel is there. And Mike Gravel was my guest a week ago, and we got into a discussion about the leading intellectual in this country about foreign affairs, Noam Chomsky. And I was admonishing Chomsky because he's belittling everybody who either looks into the Kennedy assassination or 9/11. And Mike, bless his heart, was defending Noam. I am still disappointed in Noam Chomsky, but I am so proud of you. Why did you get involved, and why are you still doing it when there doesn't seem to be anything happening?
The glaringness of what happened from the get-go, it just kept mounting up so that I could do nothing but be militant against the acceptance of the party line. And it seems to me 3,000 people dead, the most spurious reasons in the world as to how it happened.
All scientifically underscored in this brilliant 15 minutes of film. So I have a couple of questions. First of all, with these thousands of architects and engineers, all credible, why has no action been taken? Now I will add this question here. Why are the architects and engineers also hostile toward Dr. Judy Woods, who's really well-researched book, Where Did the Towers Go, is always belittled by them? I don't understand it. Why aren't they joining forces?
You caught me with my pants down. I don't know Dr. Woods, nor have I read her book, so I have no idea about the conflict that you're describing.
Oh,
I'll take your word for it.
Well, I must tell you, she came up, I mean, because the buildings, there was no wreckage. The buildings had been dustified, and here is a scientist, this lady, who feels it is some kind of energy-directed device, she doesn't call it a weapon, that dustified these buildings. And she has an enormous following around the world, and yet architects and engineers have been attacking her. So what I will do is I will see that you get a copy of that book, because I'm sure you would love to read
thank
it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Why has no action been taken when substantial people, all the way from Mike Gravel to yourself, and then these architects and engineers, what is stopping a true investigation? And would it be possible, Ed, for wealthy individuals to fund a citizen's investigation into 9/11? Especially Building 7.
You know, there's a wonderful book out, and I don't understand how it happened on the Kennedy assassination, and I don't have the exact. It's called JFK.
The Unspeakable.
Huh?
It's called JFK and the Unspeakable by James Douglas.
Who's the author?
His name is James Douglas, and it's a very, very interesting...
Wait a minute, I didn't hear it. What is it?
His name is James Douglas, and it's a very, very interesting book. There's another one up by David Talbot about Alan Dulles that is just a killer of a book. But I'll tell you something even more interesting, Ed. I will get your email address. You will give it to our producer. I am going to forward you the very best documentary ever made about the Kennedy assassination. It's called The Garrison Tapes. Jim Garrison, of course, was played by Kevin Costner in JFK. Yeah. Jim Garrison gave his one and only interview in 10 years about his case to me, which I eventually, at a cost of $250,000, had to put into a documentary. And then I added to it a special called The Last Word on the Assassination, which I did at UNLV a year and a half ago, with the best panel in the business. I will send you that. I will send you Dr. Judy Wood's book, so you stay out of your garden for a while and out of your kitchen for a while, and you will have the greatest, most informative read and look you have ever seen. So well, anyway, let's get back to why we could not have, because Mike Gravel talked about this, we have to form citizens' committees and go above the Congress and the Senate, who don't serve the people anyway. Why can we not do that?
Well, I would support and applaud any effort to do that, but the answer I come up with all the time is that we are a media-controlled nation, as are most nations, all nations, I suppose. Plus the fact we have been so force-fed America the beautiful, America the land of the free, this, that. And if we were to accept the story of 9/11 or the Kennedy assassination and all of the guilty people involved, it would be telling us that there is no Santa Claus.
We all know there is indeed no Santa Claus, and it.
Well,
you know,
we don't know that. It's like.
Well, I'll tell you an interesting comment that I tried to book Jim Garrison on in 1970 when I did the AM show in Los Angeles. He had just authored Heritage of Stone, and I was fired for trying to book him on the number one morning show in Los Angeles. When he and I talked on the phone, he said, "John, it is 1970. Do you realize that 83% of all Americans polled do not believe either Oswald acted alone or if he did it at all?" He said, "But get this, only 23% want a new investigation." So he said to me, "John, what does that say to you?" And Ed, I said to him, I said, "Mr. Garrison, it says, I know what my mother and father did in the rumble seat of the car or in the back alley or in the bed or wherever, but don't ever tell me my mother is not a virgin." And what we're going to find out when we get into the Kennedy assassination, and we know that case is still open, and we also know that 911 was a fraud. They never did investigate the collapse of Building 7, and they admit it. No. We will find out. We are not living in a democracy. As a matter of fact, political scientists all year long have saying we're living in an oligarchy, and we do nothing about it. What has been... Have there been some very famous friends of yours who agree with you about 911 but are reluctant to talk? You don't have to name names. Just say yes or no.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I find people all the time, but they don't wear placards.
Well, does that not dishearten you? I mean, they're multimillionaires. Why do they have to keep their mouths shut?
Well, let me tell you this. With 3,000 people dying and with all the people that were involved in the shipping of the steel and witnessing this and that, why have there been no martyrs? There were 100 people who met untimely deaths with the Kennedy assassination.
Yes.
I don't hear about untimely deaths on 9/11. Where have been the people who rush forward even to impale themselves on a cross of fire?
The reason, Ed, is they are there. The media doesn't cover it. Like you said, we're a media-controlled nation. Now, the other thing is, you know these people who feel as you do, but who do not come forward? How about your children and your family and those with whom you work, how do they feel about what their father is doing?
We don't discuss it.
Honestly?
They regard themselves as little people, so, I mean, who's going to listen to them? So they don't espouse their feelings as to whether they agree with me or don't agree with me.
But doesn't one of your daughters hold political office in California?
Not my daughter, no.
Oh, I thought your daughter was active in politics. I'm sorry, I must have missed.
My ex-wife's nephew is Gavin. Gavin, our lieutenant governor.
Oh, I see. Okay. Now, have you ever had conversations with him about that, or
no,
did they
I
all avoid it?
The divorce kind of estranged us.
Oh, gosh, indeed. Anyway, well, Ed, Mr. Azar, I must tell you, I am so proud that you are here, and I am so honored that you're doing what it is that you're doing, and I just hope someday, there is some kind of citizens' hearing, and I wouldn't know how to go about it, but I will send you Dr. Judy Wood's book. As a matter of fact, I had Dr. Judy Woods on as a guest. Nobody will book her, you know. I booked Muhammad Ali in 1970 when 91% of the country wanted him in jail. I put him on the air for an hour, and then Flip Wilson hired him for his variety show. Anyway, I'm going to send you a copy of that interview, a copy of her book, and a copy of the documentary, The Last Word on the Assassination. And I must thank you so, so much for being here. You're an absolute
And don't forget that I was in JFK, too.
Yes, I do. Yes. Wait a second. You played? Hold it.
Guy Bannister.
Guy Bannister. Oh, my God, and you look like him, too. I mean, I hate to tell you that. And you were both from Chicago.
Well,
that's
more
right.
Or less.
He was the head of the FBI office in Chicago. And you were wonderful in it. Oh, my God. Thanks for reminding me. Anyway, Ed, thank you so, so much for being here. Keep your email open because stuff is coming your way from me, okay?
Well, you're a delight, and I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, thank you, and I hope we get to do this again after they open the investigation. Thank you so much, Ed.
Fight fiercely, Harvard.
Okay. Have a wonderful, wonderful day and a magnificent rest of your life, Ed.
Thank you, man. And same to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. We'll be right back with the incomparable Joe Satilli.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific and I'd say historic film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back to John Barber's World. I want to thank George Knapp for that wonderful unsolicited review. If you have a chance, go to Amazon, click on The Last Word on the Assassination. You'll see 100 other great unsolicited reviews. And it is the definitive last word on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And that's all you really need to know, except there are great books like maybe Douglas's and Joan Mellon's, and of course David Talbot's, which you should get. Also, if you're looking for a little laugh or a little something to think about, John Barber's Facebook book, Volume 1, is a great read. You can open it up any place and find something you'll love or you'll hate. But it'll make you think. And now, somebody without whom I would never do this show anymore. He is, you know, to me, I've often said that the smartest man in America is Chris Hedges, and maybe he is. But I must tell you, the second smartest man is my co-pilot here. Does the best newsletter in the country, objective and interesting and informative. It's called News Vandal. He is also a sidekick now of the Chocolate Jellies. He's got his own show on a PBS radio station somewhere in the sticks. But I can't do this show, and I cannot live my life anymore without him here. Joe Satilli. Joe, welcome to the show. Was not Ed just adorable?
Well, you know, Asner is, he's a titan, and the comedic gifts that he displayed, as you talked about extensively in the interview, in As Lou Grant, in Mary Tyler Moore. And then, oh, by the way, I know that maybe you didn't give it the best review when it launched, but the thing about Lou Grant as a show itself is that what it became, and this is the kind of television we don't really see anymore. The television in the 70s, and I just want everybody to know that they need to tune in next Monday to the show, because you are going to be interviewing one of the all-time greats in the history of broadcast media, a personal hero of mine, Norman Lear. People got to tune in to hear Norman Lear, and you talk to Norman Lear. But Lou Grant was one of these fascinating shows of the 70s. Another one was Jack Klugman's Quincy,
where they would
take issues, real hard scrabble political issues, and they would set them in the world of Quincy, or in the world of Lou Grant. And you got the sense from the show Lou Grant that Ed Asner was basically using that show as a way of putting forward political issues that he cared about. And that was a fairly common thing in the 70s, in no small part because of the standards set by Norman Lear.
Well, you know what it sort of reminds me of? Because Lou Grant, when it was canceled, was a highly rated show.
It was.
It was successful with audiences. It was successful with critics. It was like the dramatic version of the Smothers Brothers show,
right,
which also was a very highly rated show and canceled by CBS. But
yes,
you must remember that CBS was the company built by William Paley, who was one of the co-creators of OSS and the Central Intelligence Agency, who long before the Warren Report was published, was making a 3-hour or 5-hour documentary hosted by Walter Cronkite explaining why John Kennedy was shot from the back by Lee Harvey Oswald.
Paley is one of the founding members of the Project Mockingbird Club. And you know what Project Mockingbird is, and I think probably our listeners know, but if you don't, Mockingbird was the CIA design program. William Paley and the Luce twins, I like to call them the Luce twins, they were really a married couple, but Claire Booth and Henry Luce, who were behind Time, Life, and Life magazine and Time magazine, also the people who got a hold of the, John?
Yes.
Right? The Zapruder film, and put it in a vault so that it can be there to warn people in perpetuity of this is what your government can do and get away with. They were all the founders.
That reminds me of the greatest joke. Horrible thing to say, a great joke about the murder of John F. Kennedy. But the greatest joke ever written about that was by Bill Hicks.
Oh, yeah.
Dad died sadly at 33. I remember him saying that when the president is elected, the chiefs of staff from the Pentagon and the CIA from Langley don't come over at his beckoning to meet with him in the Oval Office. They call him over to Langley, Virginia. and they show him a film of the murder of John Kennedy from another angle.
Angle, yeah, exactly.
I mean, oh my God, that is so. But you know, I've often thought we had satellites up there. Even the Russians had satellites. I wonder if there's any footage taken over Dealey Plaza of what really happened.
Well, yeah,
it would not surprise me.
It wouldn't surprise me. And it really does kind of feed into dovetail with what you're talking about with Mr. Asner. I kind of have to call him Mr. Asner. I was born in 69. I grew up with this guy. So you're talking about with Mr. Asner. You know, one of the fascinating things, he did play Guy Bannister. I mean, it was a wonderful role. I mean, by the way, JFK, that was the best picture that year. It did not – I mean, it is an amazing – if you just look at it as a piece of filmmaking, the editing alone
– brilliant.
In that film. I think the editing was, I want to say, by A. Kitman Ho or whatever, but the editing of that film, unbelievable. It is a wonderfully crafted film. The acting is amazing. And people forget that Ed Asner was in it. Jack Lemmon was in it.
Yes.
There was a bevy of Hollywood actors.
Kevin Bacon.
People flooded into that film to be a part of that film because it was their way of participating in an episode of truth telling, and that has not happened in any substantial way regarding 9/11. Now, one could say that's because, well, we know what the truth is of 9/11, but the problem with we know what the truth is of 9/11, really, if you just want to get to the simplest conundrum, it's of course the fact that Building 7 came down. And Building 7 came down in spite of not being hit. It came down like a controlled demolition. You actually have Dan Rather in real time speaking off the cuff, not speaking prepared statements like he seemed to have been doing when he first saw the Zapruder film, but saying, oh, well, it looks like so many times we've seen a building demolished intentionally. Well, yeah, because it was obviously –
well, Silverstein, the owner, is on right. camera saying, pull right. it.
So – you have this issue, and the question is if there was some structural reason to do it, why has that not been said? So then you start to say, well, what is it they're covering up? And that's sort of the thin edge of the wedge. But there are a lot of different theories, and here's one of the things that I want to say about the difference between 9/11. I would love to talk about what I think is the most important stuff about it, and that's the Saudis and some
– oh, please do.
But
please
before
do.
We get there, I think
okay. Excuse me. I want you to talk about the Saudis, and if you can, you know, I had Dr. Judy Wood on, and I read her book, and it's hard to refute any of the science. And I'm not a scientist, but I do have an enormous amount of street sense, street smarts, and common sense. And I must tell you, that woman is absolutely right. Why she's denigrated by architects and engineers for 9/11, I have no idea. But the other thing is, I've had Rebecca Roth on twice, who wrote Methodical Illusion, Methodical Deception, and she had pictures of Israeli students with boxes behind them of fuses, and she comes out and she blames the Mossad. And now everybody is seems to be attacking Rebecca Roth. My comment was that I don't think she's CIA because I don't think the CIA would want to be blaming Zionists and the Mossad because Zionists run not only half of the world, they run half of America, for crying out loud. So I don't want – that's my – but I am confused about Rebecca. So please, you take it from here about your perceptions about the Saudis, because when you mentioned him to me the other day, I thought it was absolutely right on.
Well, here's the thing, you know. It's the difference between then and now. You look at the Kennedy assassination, John, and you know this better than anybody. I mean, this is why you are a walking sort of national gift or treasure. There has not been a Jim Garrison about 9/11.
There has not been.
We haven't had somebody in an official position, no matter what level of government it is, conduct a full independent investigation, dig up facts, put together circumstantial cases and lots of evidence, find documents. We don't have that. The 9/11 Commission was basically a whitewash. And the where you see it the most is on the issue of the put options on American and United Airlines. Also, there were put options on British Airways. There seemed to have been some put options on gold and oil as well in the days leading up to. There were put options happening after the tech bubble burst. About 11% was there was a 40% spike of put options. But the 9/11 Commission says we didn't find anything. And apparently, from what I've read from a university professor researcher in Australia, the documents tracing it have been destroyed by the U.S. government. So, you know, if we had that information, that would be one of those thin edges of the wedges that we could follow to get into this. We haven't had that yet. So I'm always wary now, because also I think if this was a covert operation, if that's what you believe, this is a black op or covert operation, it stands to reason that many of the mistakes, because one of the things I think about JFK's assassination, John, and you might agree with me, is that it is riddled with mistakes. It is riddled with goofs. It is riddled with opportunities to find the holes in the official story. And since then, I think these operations, if this was one of those operations, would have become a little bit more nuanced, had there be more layers of plausible deniability. You have to have a lot of plausible deniability between the kill order and the implementation.
Right.
Now, if you're looking for the simplest answer, is not the Mossad and is not the Israelis. It is obviously the Saudis. And I think one of the reasons why this Rebecca Roth character, and I say character, and I say that as a journalist, because she is obviously playing a character, because as John, as you well know, and has come to your attention, it looks like she has at least two identities and maybe three. Now, whether or not she is working for the CIA, we don't know. She could be working for the CIA and not know it. And this is one of the
That's true.
Right. This is one of the problems with these kinds of situations, is that with double and triple and quadruple blind agents, people who have no idea who their ultimate puppet master is, they can be doing things, and they could be doing things quite honestly, earnestly, thinking that they're pursuing what they believe is the truth, but being fed things that are designed to put red herrings on the trail and distort information. In the case of the Mossad, we do know about the so-called dancing Israelis. It is a real thing. I've read multiple news reports from local news agencies in the tri-state area. That's, you know, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and national news agencies. They were these Israeli students. They were celebrating when it happened. They were art students, supposedly, and they were held for a short period of time and released. And there is every indication, based on mainstream reporting, that they were intelligence operatives. Okay,
right.
So we have that. But just because the Mossad may have known, and I'm saying this is predicated on the idea that we're just going to assume that this was a black operation. If just because the Mossad knew it was happening doesn't mean that they had the opportunity or the ability to run a test scenario on 9/11 itself through the NSA of hijacked planes being crashed into landmark buildings in Washington, D.C. Because, by the way, the Washington Post and others reported that what a coincidence that the NSA was running this test scenario of hijacked planes being crashed into places like the State Department.
Right.
Which makes Condoleezza Rice going before Congress and saying, we could have never known or imagined this kind of attack. Well, Condi, you were head of the NSA, and as a matter of fact, you did imagine it because you were running that test scenario, which is probably why when the NORAD got the call, the first person said, is this real world or test?
I remember. Because but why the Saudis? Why the Saudis?
Well, so when you get to the Saudis, I just want to – this is really recent reporting here. So you know, just to clear it up, it does make sense to blame the Mossad and Israel if you wanted to run a red herring, because then the people who attack the 9/11 story get branded as anti-Semites and they become instantly marginalized. Because
very true.
There's no quicker way to be marginalized than to be an anti-Semite, which is why I am not an anti-Semite, and I am very careful of anti-Semites who entreat me to cover stories, because That's a red flag to me. But here's a really big red flag waving. This is from the New York Times. This is, I'm just going to read the opening paragraph. This is January 23rd of this year by Mark Mazzetti and Matt Apuzzo. A couple of good paisanos there. When President Obama secretly authorized the Central Intelligence Agency to begin arming Syria's embattled rebels in 2013, the spy agency knew it would have a willing partner to help pay for the covert operation. It was the same partner the CIA has relied on for decades for money and discretion in far-off conflicts, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Since then, the CIA and its Saudi counterpart have maintained an unusual arrangement for the rebel training mission, which the Americans have codenamed Timber Sycamore. Under the deal, current Saudi administration officials said the Saudis contribute both weapons and large sums of money, and the CIA takes the lead in training the rebels on AK-47s and assault rifles and tank-destroying missiles. This goes on, this whole story goes on to detail, going back decades, how basically the Saudis have been an adjunct of the CIA around the world.
Then why would the Saudis instead? I mean, because Netanyahu wanted us to go into Iraq. So it's understandable if he says to the Mossad, bring down those buildings and change their foreign policy.
Well, see, why, you know who really wanted to get Iraq?
Who?
Was the Saudis.
Ah.
Because
expand on that. Expand on
that. Because Saddam Hussein blamed the Saudis for the first Gulf War, and Saddam Hussein was a primary competitor as a non-religious power in a secular nation in the Middle East. And over the course of the 90s, the oil reserves of Iraq went from the fifth or fourth largest in the world to the second largest in the world in the course of a decade, because so much of the oil stayed in the ground while everybody else pumped their oil. And before he was taken out, and while he was about to really come into compliance with UN sanctions, that was the problem. He was in compliance. The UN knew it. Scott Ritter knew it. All of these people knew it. And before he could come into compliance, he had to be dealt with, because what he said he was going to do was flood the world market with cheap oil and use the euro instead of the dollar. And what that was going to do was completely destabilize the Saudi hold on the world's oil market, because oil at that time was trading at about $17 a barrel. He wanted to drive the price of oil down to 8 or 9, which would have bankrupted the Saudis.
Oh, my God.
Bankrupted them.
Gracious.
Also, the Saudis intimately involved throughout their entire history with the Bush family, going all the way back. You have Bandar Bush, who is ambassador to Washington, D.C. He's Prince Bandar al-Sultan, but he's actually was called Bandar Bush. And Barbara Bush talked about how he was such a member of the family. They loved how he would get up in the morning on Sundays and make breakfast for the whole family. He had sleepovers. He was a member of the family, Bandar. Well, here's another interesting little story. I know we're running out of time. This is another interesting story that followed up on the Mazzetti Apuzzo story I just read from. And this is from Nawif Abayid and Nawaf Obayid. And Nawaf Obayid is a senior fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. So this guy, he could be a Saudi functionary or not, but this is what he wrote in Al Monitor just a few days ago. Saudi Arabia's execution of 47 accused terrorists on January 2nd drew extensive condemnation in the United States. This was the famous execution of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, the Shiite refusenik inside Saudi Arabia, that was seen as a thumbing of the nose by the Saudis and a challenge to the Iranians. It turned into a little dust-up international incident. Well, here's what he says about this. He says, the 47 men executed were proven terrorists and criminals, all of whom had committed or inspired murder, and many of whom had direct links to al-Qaeda or the terrorist Shiite group Hezbollah al-Hejaz, which is the Saudi Hezbollah. Further, he says, the al-Qaeda links were established legal fact. Indeed, 43 of those executed were tied to the men who carried out 9/11.
Oh, my goodness.
They had been fighters, recruiters, senior commanders, and theologians in the terrorist group behind the horrors of the attacks on the World Trade Center, United Flight 93, and the Pentagon. Furthermore, they had been part of the local Saudi branch of al-Qaeda that carried out a series of terrorist attacks between 2003 and 2006 in the kingdom in an attempt to foment mass murder on a scale equal to or beyond 9/11.
Where did you read that? In any American paper?
No, this is in Al Monitor, which is an English language paper that comes out of the Middle East, and it is my number one go-to source. I go to it every day when I'm building the rundown. And this is a guy at the Kennedy Center for Government at Harvard writing this. So if you think about the 28 pages that Senator Bob Graham and many other activists in Congress have tried to get released, because there are 28 pages that the U.S. government says the American people cannot see, and they detail Saudi Arabia's links to 9/11. We also know.
Is there anyone? It was like Mike Gravel was the one that introduced the Pentagon Papers. Is there anyone that you could think of now? A Chris Hedges, anyone, a Cynthia McKinney, who could bring this information and this article to the public's attention?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, Senator Bob Graham. He was on the Intelligence Committee. He was from Florida. He was there. He was in the Congress at 9/11. He has been fighting since he left Congress to get this information out about the Saudi connections. The problem is where do the Saudi connections lead? If you think about that Apuzzo and Mazzetti article I read, they lead right back to the CIA.
That's the
problem. So all of these red herrings from these Rebecca Ross about the Mossad could not do the things necessary on 9/11 to open the door for 9/11 to happen.
Well, I must tell you, Joe, you are an absolute, absolute treasure. Gosh, I'd be lost without you. Anyway, everybody should be getting your News Vandal for this kind of information. My God, it's thrilling to know and necessary to know. So where can they get it? Where can they hear you again? Until next Monday with me. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, John. You're too kind. Just go to newsvandal.com, newsvandal.com. When you go to my page, a little box will pop up, and you can sign up right there. It's as easy as that, and then you will get the rundown 5 days a week. And then, of course, I'm on the Ocelli Effect. You can Google that on American Freedom Radio, and then you can go to Crew FM. That's the little place in the sticks where every week I do Inside the Headlines with the News Vandal on Fridays, 2 p.m. Pacific. And, John, I'm always, always – this is really the best part of my week, is being on the air with you, and so looking forward to your interview of Norman Lear next week.
Oh, I can't wait. Norman Lear and you, two absolute treasures. Can't wait. Anyway, thank you so much, Joe. Thank you all for listening. This will be archived, and Joe and I will be talking to you Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific time. Norman Lear, Monday night, one of the true giants of American television. Bye-bye.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.